This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 52. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers with awesome launching software products, whether you've built your first product or just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week, Rob?
I bought myself a SaaS application.
Ah.
I'm not sure I actually talked about this particular acquisition before. At one point, probably 10 episodes ago, I mentioned that someone had approached me with kind of a larger SaaS app, and that fell through. I wound up not wanting to move forward with it. Gosh, within a couple of months of that, I was, you know, going through my idea notebook, and I had a couple conversations with some kind of trusted colleagues, and was basically asking, what's my next niche? You know, I was asking this to myself. I was actually asking myself, what's my next move, period? Like, do I write another book? Do I go out and start another blog? Or do I, whatever. I mean, I was just trying to think, like, what am I excited about doing? And what's going to provide a lot of value to people? And I realized that I'm excited about doing, you know, another SaaS app, frankly, and kind of doing one that's maybe a little bigger than the other ideas that I've done in the past. And we talked a little bit about this when we went on Texting. In essence, I made a list in my notebook, and it wasn't a list of products or niches. It was a list of problems that entrepreneurs have. And I came up with about 10 or 11 of them. Examples were like, entrepreneurs want more visitors to their website. Entrepreneurs want to blog, but they don't have time to do it. I mean, I was just kind of thinking of all the problems that I've heard come up the most with people that I talk to, whether through my blog, through the academy, or through, you know, the speaking gigs I do. I was trying to think of ways to solve those problems. And after talking to a few colleagues who I talk to a lot, I figured out, wow, I really want to do something in the marketing space. And specifically, as I honed it down, I realized, wow, I want to do something in that like organic search space, like the search engine optimization area. Not black hat stuff, but the white hat stuff. And so I was designing a tool and looking at building something, and I had the idea in mind and remembered that there was a website that already did this, and it was a SaaS app that was essentially not being developed. It was being just basically supported, but it was having some issues with downtime and such. So I did a cold email to the owner, and we negotiated for about 2 months, and then just a couple weeks ago, we went through the escrow process, and I now own hittail.com.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I realize that was a very long soliloquy about how that came about, but wanted to give folks some background. So yeah, it's hit and then TAIL.com. So it's like long tail, hittail.com. It's cool. It's a real-time SEO keyword tool that uses your traffic to tell you keywords that you will rank high for just by writing like a single blog post with these keywords in the title. It's almost guaranteed that you will get to the first page of Google for this thing, and typically rank pretty, you know, even high up on the first page. So that's what it does. So you install a little snippet on your website, you know, a JavaScript snippet, and then it just analyzes it and has a proprietary algorithm. And those were kind of the reasons I acquired it. It was for there's a little bit of the technology. The technology is not expansive, but it's very well written and it's intelligent. The other thing is, you know, the marketing already exists. I mean, the thing has a lot of links and it has existing customer base, and it has, you know, it's a working app. And, you know, I mean, you know that going from zero to a working app to then an app with customers is a huge amount of effort. And so that's why I decided to shortcut the process. It was worth, you know, the purchase price to not have to go through those steps.
Oh, believe me, I know.
Seriously, you know, it's like you can spend months building something, or if someone out there had a code base that did what, you know, you want Autochurch to do, or did half of what you wanted it to do, you would have paid quite a bit of money for that. I don't think there's any doubt, you know, to save yourself the time.
I don't know about that. I think in general, I probably would. Like, if it was something that I didn't have a very firm idea of exactly how it needed to be done, then yeah, I probably would. But I think Autochurch is a little different, just because I have that unique insight that I don't think anybody else would have. And getting a look at their code base before I bought it is a little problematic, you know. I mean, I know you can, but it's just a little harder, and it would take a lot longer to kind of analyze and figure it out. I don't know as I would have done it for Autochurch, but I can definitely see for Hittail, I definitely would have bought it.
Right, you could see the advantage of kind of skipping over those early steps. Yeah, and I've struggled with it, and I've talked to a few people about it because I want to do it. I mean, I really, you know, want to grow Hittail. into a fairly sizable business. And I was kind of in my own head like, wow, am I cheating by not building this from scratch? Am I really a founder or an entrepreneur because I didn't, you know, I didn't write every line of code in this thing? And I finally realized it doesn't matter who's keeping score. No, but I build this thing into a sizable business, and, you know, sizable is anyone's definition. But I mean, let's say it's doing 500 grand a year or something ultimately, or a million. It doesn't matter if I didn't write everything. Like, it doesn't matter to me. And so I just decided, screw it, I'm going to move forward with it. So,
yeah, I mean, the thing is, by the time you grow it to that size, chances are good that it's probably, you probably hired somebody to help write code and you didn't write pieces anyway. So certainly. Does it really matter?
I mean, that's a good point. I mean, even this week, I'm moving the app from its old servers to a new managed facility. And that, you know, has a lot of complications with it that I didn't anticipate. And so I had to hire a DBA as an example. So already he's making changes, you know, and he's like, oh, I'm going to rewrite this stored procedure. He's like, we need to redo the logins because, you know, I can make it more secure. And I mean, there were just all these things. And I suddenly realized, hey, like, yeah, already the app is not really, not even mine. You know, I'm only 2 weeks into it. How about you? What's going on?
Mostly just working on AutoShark. I finally got things working end to end. By end to end, I mean that I can create a account, install a service on a machine in my environment or in a domain environment, and then essentially things will sync up between the service that's installed in your environment and the cloud, and then from the cloud you can go out there and you can say target this machine for an audit, and the service will pick it up, run the audit, and then pipe all the results back. And I still have to test it, but I believe that all of the audit results are going to be stored back into the Azure tables that I'm using for the back end for all the results and stuff. Right after that, all I think I need to do is do a little bit around reporting and then build an interface to generate the rules that actually run behind the scenes to do the audits. And that is basically it. I mean, then after that, it's just all of the, you know, marketing and all the associated things that go along with it, like hooking up a billing system and, you know, all the other stuff.
Right.
Doing the marketing.
So in the interest of busting your chops, as it were, there was some original talk about the end of June for Alpha, and then you actually had something come up. There was actually something legitimate that came up, and it was end of July, was rescheduled pretty quickly. And then I think we talked in end of July, and you said it might be a couple more weeks. So that would have been kind of middle of August.
Mm-hmm.
It's the beginning of September,
yep.
And you are, I mean, you would say that you're an Alpha, like the product itself functions and someone could use it end to end. The thing you're missing, like you said, is reporting and the way for people to build rules. Is that right?
Yeah.
Just those two big pieces of functionality. Because I don't consider like payment processing. I mean, yes, it's part of the product, but I mean, you can definitely go into alpha and beta without that code, you know?
Oh, totally. I mean, I think the big thing for me right now is really, I treat it as if it's in an alpha state right now, because theoretically I could hand this to some customers, put it in their environment and have it work. And the fact is that because the service can be automatically updated on the fly, I don't necessarily have to worry about that either. So theoretically, I could give somebody an alpha and without them having to touch anything can kind of migrate to a beta and then to kind of a full-blown production environment without them ever having to touch anything or update anything.
Right. It's nice.
So all of that stuff is done. In terms of the interface to create the rules that'll be executed on the target machines, I can create those manually by hand right now, but it takes about 10 times longer to do it by hand than it would if I had an actual interface. So that's more for my sanity and expediency to actually get the rules built that can be built into the policies and executed on the machines. And then for the reporting, my expectation is I'm going to be doing some very simplistic reporting out of the gate, because once I've got the data, then I can build reports. I just need the data in order to be able to build the reports. But once I have the data, I can build as many reports as I want. It doesn't matter. So just having that data is kind of enough for the time being. I mean, I can go into alpha without having extensive reporting. That's not a big deal.
Right. Cool. It looks like you have a note here that something happened with your MacBook Air. What's the deal with that?
Well, you remember how I was telling you I was having those VMware Fusion issues where it would shut down and wouldn't necessarily wake up. I took it to the Apple store and the guy looked at it and he thought that it might have been a hardware issue. So he just said, well, let's replace this and I'll give you a brand new one. And they went ahead and migrated all of my data from my existing MacBook Air to a brand new one. And it's nice to get that level of service, but at the end of the day, I don't think it was necessary because I don't think that there was necessarily anything wrong with the old one. I think that the guy just looked at it and said, yeah, you're having this problem. I see that it's a problem. I don't know what the solution is, so I'm going to give you a new one.
Huh. And did it fix the problem?
No. I'm fairly certain that I've kind of narrowed it down. I think what's happening is that because VMware Fusion is running Windows in the background and I have it on a separate desktop, when the machine goes to sleep and it is not plugged in, what's happening is that the Windows side of things says, oh, well, I'm working on battery power right now, because it's passing through the information that says it's operating on a battery or is plugged in or whatever. And I think what's happening is that when it decides that it wants to go to sleep because Windows is still kind of running, then it tries to take control of the screen. And because you've got two operating systems trying to either dim the monitor or turn it off or what have you at the same time, I think VMware Fusion is getting kind of confused and then hanging, and then it just black screens. I think that's the problem, to be honest.
Right.
And it seems to make sense. I just need to figure out what settings I need to toggle to tell it not to, to worry about that. And I've turned off the dimming of the monitor in Windows, so I'm hoping that that'll fix it. But it just takes so long to test it. I don't necessarily care. I just know that I know the workaround for it. I just don't feel like it most of the time. And I don't, you know, I try to keep it plugged in as much as possible anyway.
Right. Well, hey, we have two new reviews in iTunes, and this is awesome. We actually have 50 ratings now, and it looks like, I mean, the average is 5-star. Yeah, we have 48 5-stars and one 4-star and one 1-star. So, again, it's awesome. This totally helps us rank, you know, really well in iTunes for, like, you know, we've talked about, you just search for startups, and we're there. I think we're after, like, This Week in Startups, which is a wildly popular podcast. So for the amount of listeners we have, we rank really well. And we have two really cool reviews. One's from Nathan Prather, and it says, I'm a member of the Micropreneur Academy, and this weekly podcast is a great supplement to the material. Thanks, and keep it up, Rob and Mike. And then the other one is, it's from Scott Watermassis. It says, great practical advice. Rob and Mike provide a ton of hands-on, real-world practical advice. Highly recommended for developers interested in starting their own business. So we really appreciate that. And you know, if you haven't left us a review or left us a rating in iTunes, we really would appreciate it if you could swing in there and do that. I have this tool that is so freaking cool that I had to talk about it. I needed to compare. I acquired Hittail, and it has two servers, and the code bases were, they're supposed to be identical, but they were different between the two of them.
No.
Yeah, shocking, huh? They weren't synced. They were being manually synced, which means not synced at all. So I was going to like download both of them and like copy them over each other and look, compare file by file and stuff. And Ruben for bidsketch.com, he said, use a tool called Beyond Compare.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing is crazy. It is crazy good. And I remember when I came to the site, I was looking at what it does, and you can compare code between multiple servers, like two different servers, and it'll show you the file, like the directory differences.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can just drill down immediately into files. It'll compare images. It'll compare like database files, like Access database. It'll compare text files. It'll compare binary. I mean, just craziness. And I'm looking at all the features, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to pay like hundreds. This is like an enterprise tool. This is what I was thinking. I'm going to have to pay hundreds of dollars. And I think, I don't remember what it was. I think it's $30.
I thought it was like 50, but yeah, it's pretty cheap.
Whatever it was trivial. Like when I saw what it could do for me, I was just blown away. So I used it, and it just cut the task. I don't know why I didn't think to look for something like this, but I was going to do it manually, and it would have taken me hours, and it wound up taking me about 15 or 20 minutes. So it was ridiculous how cool that was, and I totally recommend it for someone if you have to compare stuff, even on an ongoing basis. It's amazing.
The standard tool is $30. The Pro Edition is $50.
I didn't need the Pro Edition, so.
Yeah, I forget what the version, the difference is between them, but I've used it before. It's an awesome tool. It's made by Scooter Software. So if you're looking for it, it's at scootersoftware.com, and we'll link to that in the show notes.
And it's really well written, easy to use, intuitive. I mean, everything you would hope for, and then it actually works. Like, I was impressed with it.
What I always liked was you could do like a three-way merge. So you could take three different files that were different and merge all three of them together, or merge based on two previous versions of it into a third version. It was awesome.
Yep. Yeah, I can do all kinds of stuff I haven't even looked into. You know, I just had this one application and it was worth it. But yeah, you're right. It has way more advanced features than I've even talked about here.
So Dan Andrews from the Lifestyle Business Podcast thought that you were cruel in episode 50 for the last episode joke.
It was your joke. You're the one that was like, let's do this
but
last
you episode. Let me go through with it.
I let...
Your fault.
So I'm responsible.
You are responsible.
Mike wanted to leave it till the end of the episode and say right at the beginning that we were going to end the podcast with episode 50 and then at the very end or dispel the myth, but I made him do it like 2 minutes later because I couldn't stand it. I was concerned how many people would unsubscribe in that 30-minute listening time.
You know, I think I must have had a mean streak between the last episode and this one. The day that Hurricane Irene was making landfall, it was either North Carolina or closer to us, I forget which. I went on a helicopter ride at a local fair at the elementary school here in town. I started taking pictures from the helicopter ride and posting them on Facebook and telling everybody I was taking a helicopter ride into the hurricane. And there were all these people who were going nuts, like, be careful.
Nice.
And of course, I didn't tell them otherwise. Of course, somebody sends a Facebook message to my wife and says, what is Mike doing?
Right.
Today's podcast came from a couple of different things. The first one was in the last podcast when you talked about episode 29 being one of the most popular episodes. I went back and checked it out, and I think I realized why it struck a chord with so many people. We talked a lot about the things that people encounter so frequently that they apply to almost anyone, whether you're a developer or not. You know, things like working late, trying to be the hero, being the victim at work, and you know, taking responsibility for where you're at today. And it reminded me of when I left Pedestal Software back in 2005, and shortly after that, I had lunch with the ex-CEO, and he asked me why I left. And after I explained it to him, I said, you know, I just wanted to go out and do my own thing and kind of be a little bit more in control of the things that I was doing and working on. And he said, you want to be master of your own destiny. And that's exactly it. So that was the first thing. And the second thing that brought this topic to mind was that it was one of the things that you mentioned in your microconf speech, which you know I thought was an absolutely amazing analogy, but it was the difference between being on a hamster wheel and a flywheel. And can you take a few minutes to explain the kind of the basic concept that you went over at the microconf?
Yeah, sure. You know, most people know what a hamster wheel is, right? It's a wheel that a little hamster gets on and it runs. And as long as it's running, the wheel turns. And when the hamster stops running, the wheel stops. Now, a flywheel, most people aren't familiar with. Basically, a flywheel is typically a very large stone wheel. It can be metal. It's something very heavy. And a flywheel is really hard to get going. So you have to push really hard to get the thing to start turning. You push for a long time. And eventually, if it starts turning pretty fast, you can let go of it and it will just sit there and it'll turn and turn and turn for a long time because it has so much momentum. You know, again, going back to a hamster wheel, really easy to get started, but stops right away when you stop moving on it. So there are a bunch of benefits to flywheels. There's real world applications of them in generators that serve web hosting facilities and colo facilities, but that's kind of boring tech stuff, so I won't go into it here.
So today we're going to talk about the first steps that you need to get off the hamster wheel. And this week's episode is called Getting Off the Hamster Wheel. And step one to getting off the hamster wheel is you have to decide that you want to get off of the wheel. I mean, and this is the single most important step. You need to decide that you need to get off the hamster wheel, not just that you want to get off it or that you would like to, but you need to get off of it. There are things going on. You just can't deal with them anymore. And you need something else. And part of this is evaluating where you are today and not only what got you here, but where you would like to be. What would you rather be doing? And if the answer is doing the same thing that you're doing today, then maybe staying on the hamster wheel isn't such a bad thing. And the fact is that although we talk about it like being on a hamster wheel is bad, it's not always a bad thing for everybody. Some people, you know, like being on that. They like having that continuity and knowing that they're working on stuff, and when they stop working on it, nothing else moves forward. But I think a lot of people kind of really relate to the idea of building a business and being able to take a break from it and walk away for a little while and come back to it, and things are still going. Things are still going in the direction that you originally pointed them to. I'm sure you may have to make some adjustments here and there to get them back on track a little bit because, you know, it's kind of like a sailboat. Things will veer off a little bit if you're not paying attention to the tiller the entire time, but it generally goes in the direction that you want as long as you're not away for too long.
Yeah, and I think kind of some underlying assumptions that underlie what you just said is that we consider salaried employment a hamster wheel. right? It's something that you have to go into work every day and you have to work a certain amount of hours in order to get this check. And it's similar with hourly consulting. If you're trading your hours for dollars, that's really what we're talking about here. Whereas, you know, having a product, more of a business, even having investments, you know, if you have investments that make money on a recurring basis, I mean, these are the flywheels that you put in motion. And we're not going to talk about investments because we're not investment experts, but we can talk about the entrepreneurial side of things. That's what we'll be talking about in our five steps today. So step two is to figure out what it's going to take to get off the hamster wheel. There are a bunch of different ways to think about becoming more self-sufficient and getting away from the dollars for hours kind of mentality or situation. You have to think about, do you need to change your job? You need to think about, do you need to quit your job? I mean, this is something I think a lot of entrepreneurs struggle with early on, is at what point am I going to have to take the leap from a salaried employment to basically being an entrepreneur? Do you need to develop your own products in order to get off the hamster wheel? That's the way that both Mike and I have approached it. They're certainly not the only ways to do it. As I said, there are ways to do it through investments. Some people do it through real estate. That's actually the path. Before I really started getting hardcore into entrepreneurship, I totally went down the real estate road, and I owned a bunch of houses in Los Angeles.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I did. I owned a total of 7 units. It wasn't 7 properties. There were a bunch of 2-on-a-lots, but 7 units in LA. And some of them were with other investors and friends and such. But yeah, that was going to be my ticket to independence, to where I could quit my job. And in my own experience, there were a couple drawbacks to it. One, I wasn't totally in control of it, because when the housing market tanked, like, I lost literally hundreds of thousands of dollars in paper wealth. And I realized, like, wow, the market can basically make or break you in this thing. And that didn't feel great. I feel like as an entrepreneur, I'm much more in control of my destiny. There are always market forces that can come out and get you. Plus, in the end, I just realized I enjoyed, you know, the entrepreneurship side more than managing properties and doing the deals. That wasn't that interesting to me. I was more doing it as a means to an end, whereas entrepreneurship, I actually enjoy the process of it. I think the last point of this, you know, step two I was talking about before I wandered off, is figure out what it's going to take. And the last point of this is, if you are going to pursue entrepreneurship and you are going to develop your own products or SaaS apps or mobile apps, whatever it is, you need to think about potentially making some pretty heavy sacrifices in order to make that happen. You're going to have to carve out 15, 20 hours a week of free time. So you might have to cut back on your hours at work. You might have to, you know, take Fridays off, take a lower salary, do something in order to get this thing kickstarted. Because trying to just fit 5 or 10 hours a week in, it's going to take you a long, long time to get there. And I mean, if you're doing really small ideas, you can pull it off, but it's going to take you a lot longer than if you're, you know, able to spend more like 15 plus hours a week on it.
So step three is a follow-up to step two. And what step three involves is accepting the responsibility and the consequences of those actions. And this is really hard. There's no way around it. And anyone who says otherwise is lying. Making big changes in your life is really difficult, and it can be really scary sometimes. But there are times when the pain of what you're doing now becomes so great that you just have to accept that something needs to be done about it, and you need to do it. Making big changes like this is right up there with the top forms of stress in people's lives. I mean, changing jobs, getting married, buying a house, all of these things are very difficult to do because they're very stressful. And making huge changes in your life and accepting the responsibility and consequences of those actions is not going to be any different. I mean, when you go through this, it is going to be stressful and you are going to worry about it, and you will probably lose some sleep at night. But if you accept that this is something that absolutely needs to be done to make your life better, then it makes it a little bit easier to sleep at night. And as you start to see results, things will get better over time.
Well, and I think there's ways to avert risk as well, right? Or to kind of minimize risk. I have realized it's only been over the past few years that I am very conservative when it comes to risk. Like, I'm the entrepreneur who does not like to put too much on the table. I've never risked bankruptcy. I've never risked major financial meltdown. I don't have it in me. I think I would stress out too much. So I avoid that. And as a result, I look at situations. I mean, as I transitioned from salaried employee to consultant and then consultant to kind of supporting myself from products, I moved fairly slowly, but I was never at a point where I couldn't turn around pretty easily and go back if I needed to. certain people work different ways. And so if you need to burn a bridge to be motivated, then do it. And I know people who've done that. You know, as an example, before I stopped consulting and kind of started referring my clients to other developers, which I guess in a way it wasn't burning bridges per se, but, you know, I was getting rid of work. I would have had to find new work from scratch. Before I did that, my products were generating about 70% of my, it was 70% of what I needed to live on, because my consulting income was actually quite a bit more than what I needed to live on. And I had a good chunk of savings, so I had a pretty long runway. Now, I know people who quit after they have a product making 10% of what they need to live on. To me, that sounds crazy. You can totally make it work, but it's just a, it's not going to work as often as, you know, someone who leaves when they have 70%. All that to say is that there are going to be consequences of your actions, especially if, you know, quitting a job, leaving an income source, whatever, and it is hard. But depending on how you react to risk is probably how you need to approach it. There's no right answer. So step four for getting off the hamster wheel is to create a plan to get from point A to point B. You know, as Mike said, making dramatic changes in your life, it's really scary and it's often pretty stressful and it's often hard to do something like quitting your job or leaving consulting behind or whatever it is that you're going to refocus your life on something, it's scary. But if you plan appropriately, you can eliminate the real and the imagined risks associated with it. So keeping the imagined risks in mind is important. For example, job security is an imagined risk. No job in the world is safe, especially today. Not a month goes by when I don't talk to a friend who, even if layoffs aren't happening right now in their company, will be talking casually and, you know, they talk about being an entrepreneur and mention that how, you know, a couple years ago there were layoffs at their company and how that made them feel, that they felt totally out of control and really not safe at their job, which is something that probably our parents felt. If they worked somewhere for 30 or 40 years, they really did feel that there was a promise that they would be at their job. So imagine risk. It's a big deal. It's deluding yourself. You know, it's not looking at the way the cards really are.
As Rob was saying, creating that plan to get from point A to point B, there's no reason that that plan can't include backup plans or follow-ups and different data points that say, okay, well, if I get to this point, then I need to make a change in the course of action and I maybe need to think about doing something different. Don't be afraid to change those plans, though, if things are dramatically not working the way that you expected them to, because plans will change. They will evolve over time. And don't think that just because you wrote it down on paper and said, oh, well, I need to do this in this time frame, if you get to there and you start making decisions based on new data that you're getting, that's okay. It's okay to deviate from the plan. But the idea is to put a plan in place that will help to, you know, mitigate risks that you may not have thought about, that you are thinking about and saying, okay, well, what can I do about this? Or, you know, what can I do to change this particular course of action from a bad outcome into a good outcome? And, you know, these plans are all about just getting you to think about the different things that could happen and how you're going to deal with them.
One other point I wanted to make about this is there's a lot of fear in making these changes. And I was actually listening to a podcast a few weeks ago. I don't remember who it is. Basically, this is the guy mentioned a technique that I've used for years. My wife taught it to me as a psychologist. It's basically like you have this fear of, let's take, for example, like leaving a salary job, right? Leaving what you feel is safe. And you take that fear and think, oh my gosh, what's the worst that could happen? Typically, the worst that could happen is, I remember when I was leaving my job, the worst that could happen is I would go back and get another job. Because I had never been unemployed. Like I had never had trouble finding a job. I guess ultimately the real worst that could happen is that I wouldn't be able to find a job. I'd lose my house and we'd have to move into an apartment. Then I'd find another job. Like I remember thinking through this whole process and being like, wow, A, I don't think that losing my house and not getting another job is even a viable option at this point because I had very marketable skills. And B, even if that did happen, is it worth staying at this job that I despise and doing this hamster wheel thing just because I'm scared of the slight possibility that that might happen? It put it into perspective for me. And it was, you know, one of the reasons that made me, motivated me to, you know, get off my butt and start building products on the side, frankly. And the same thing when I was finally leaving consulting was, what's the worst that could happen here? And it's like, well, I'll need to go back and find new consulting clients. Again, the worst is I won't find consulting clients. I'll lose the house, blah, blah, blah. But the odds of that happening are so small. Asking yourself what's really the worst that can happen and trying to put it into words and quantify it actually removes the kind of the unknown, the shadow side of it that you can't see. You know, it's not knowing it that is where the real fear lies.
Step five of getting off the hamster wheel is to actually take action from the plans that you've put together. And as the Nike slogan reads, just do it. If you have a reasonable plan in place to get from point A to point B, what's stopping you from doing it? Anything that you can point to as a major hurdle needs to be addressed. Either plan for it or create contingencies, fix it and move on. And eventually you need to take action, assuming that, you know, you have decided to go through step one and you absolutely have decided that you need to get off the hamster wheel.
I think the good topper to this, to the show, is to say there's two sides to taking action. One side is the practical side, right? It's what we talk about quite a bit on the podcast, deciding on a niche and figuring out how to market it and building a product. And that's the practical side and the, you know, actionable side. The other side is this taking action in your head, and it's getting over the fear. And we've talked about this maybe on two or three podcasts in the past. And as you said, I think episode 29 was one, and it's a very popular episode. That's the part that actually I think trips people up maybe more than these manual steps that we all talk about. You know, building a business is hard and it takes a lot of creativity and drive, but you have to be in the mental headspace to be able to do it. Even if you know all the steps, if you don't have the motivation and this ability to look fear in the face and just be like, you know, you're not going to beat me, I'm basically going to overcome you, then you're not going to make it very far, even if you know the right steps that you should be taking.
And I think that's part of what creating a plan to get from point A to point B is about, because it really forces you to think, what do I need to do? What are the different things that could happen? And it helps you eliminate those scary things that are mostly unknowns. For example, is what you said in step four is people think that they have job security. Well, job security is an imagined risk. And if they sit down and they think about their plan to get from point A to point B, they're going to realize that that's an imagined risk. It's not a real risk. As you start walking through these different things that are scary, you're going to realize that they're not nearly as scary as you thought, because you start identifying all the things that could be potential roadblocks for you.
Hey, Rob and Mike. My name's Corey Moss, former member of the Preparer Academy. I now run a website called thebirdie.com, birdie with a Y. I had a question for you. After 49, you talk about getting people engaged, people investing time. What I'm finding with the Birdie, which is a spending tracker, is that most people invest a couple of days in tracking their spending, sign in, realize how much they're spending, and then freak out and never come back. So I was wondering if you guys could talk about sort of the psychology behind things like fear of people using your product or the experience they have. And then I'd also just love to maybe have you do a show sometime about different sort of psychological challenges you've faced with customers. Anyway, I love the podcast. Keep up the great work. Thanks.
Thanks for the question, Corey. I think that what your question boils down to is essentially that you're delivering bad news to people about their spending habits and drawing attention to it. And it sounds to me like the possible solution to that would be education. So what you need to do, I think, is to try and educate these people about not just what their spending habits are, but what they can do about it and how they can resolve whatever issues there are. Because if you have an application that, you know, you're drawing attention to where it is that they are losing money or wasting money, then you also need to point them to a solution. And if you're pointing them just to the problems without a measurable or quantifiable solution that will help solve the problem, then all you're doing is delivering bad news. And I don't know of very many, I mean, I don't think that I would probably use a product that just pointed out all the problems to me and said, well, you figure it out, or you do what needs to be done. I think that the reason Mint.com was so successful was that what they would do is they would point you to where you were spending the most money and then show relevant, they weren't quite search results, but they would show you different ways that you could save money or spend less money and come out with essentially a better outcome for yourself. Rob, what do you think?
I think you've hit the nail on the head with it. I think Corey used the phrase, people, there's like a fear of using his product, And it doesn't sound like it's actually a fear of using it. It sounds like people are using it, and then he's giving them bad news, and then they're running away. So maybe it's the fear of coming back, of using it again, that he really needs to attack. And I think Mint is a great example. It's like you said, they showed a problem and then offered solutions. I think he could even take it one step further and start doing some financial literacy teaching. You know, and not only could it be content marketing, but in terms of just marketing the service by putting together some really solid content. I mean, Ramit Sethi does this at IWillTeachYouToBeRich.com. He talks a lot about financial literacy and learning about debt and credit cards and all that stuff. Not only would it be good marketing, but then you could run through someone's account and then say, oh, you know, you're spending a lot on food. Like, here's a specific video that talks about like how to get around that. You know, here's either how to cook cheaper or how to psychologically think about why you don't need to go out to eat or whatever it is that you put together. I mean, I'm certainly not an expert on this, so I don't want to throw out ideas of specific content that will address these issues. But the idea is that if you either know it yourself or you hire some people to put together some really meaningful stuff, you can educate your audience as well as bring new people to the service. I hope that helps. And thanks again for the question, Corey. If you have a question or comment, call it into our voicemail number like Corey did at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider writing a review in iTunes by searching for Startups, and you can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com. A full transcript of it is available at our website, startupsfortherestofus.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.